Welcome to Bi Plus, podcasting for the Bi Plus universe. This is Elizabeth Meacham, and today I'm speaking with Meg Ellison about her book, The Book of Flora, which is part three of the Road to Nowhere series. Tell us a bit about your background, yourself and your background, Meg.
So I grew up a military brat with the United States Army, and I lived all over the country, and I had an itinerant experience from a very young age, which is why both the Book of Flora and the series move around the way they do, because I had such different experiences of like a year of cicadas in the Midwest versus storms in the Northeast versus, you know, West Coast weather never changing but turning up fires and earthquakes every couple of years. And I think that experience enriched my work. So I grew up really poor and moving around a lot, as most Army brats do. And I ended up a weird kid. I was more interested in books than in other people because I couldn't count on other people being around, but I could read the same books for years at a time. I grew up weird. I grew up sort of isolated, again, because of moving around so often and because of being different. I knew I was queer from a young age, and I carried that experience with me, and I sought out books that helped explain that experience to myself. I was on my own at a really young age, from about 14, and I got my first job then and learned to support myself. And then I didn't go to college until I dropped out of high school, and I didn't go to college until my mid-20s. So I've had an out-of-order experience as compared to most other folks. I've been married for 13 years, and I live in the Bay Area in California, which is another thing I picked out of a book. I really love it here, and I get to live the life I always wanted here. All I ever wanted was to be a writer and to be part of the literary scene, and I'm doing that now, and I get to be colleagues with some people who I've looked up to as heroes. So if that's not winning, I don't know what is.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. But you've done a lot.
I really have.
Where are some of the places you've lived?
So I lived in Missouri for a long time when I was a young child, which is why so much of the book takes place in the Midwest. I lived in different parts of the South. I've lived in Savannah and around Georgia a little bit. I've lived in South Carolina and Nevada and Utah, which is why I became so intimate with the desert. Southern California, Northern California, a little bit in New York. And then when I was a kid in Germany, which is where we were initially stationed. So I have a little bit of experience of living abroad. I actually went back to Germany when I was about 19. I almost became an expat. That was another adventure.
You've had a lot. You've had a lot of adventures, man. But this
I really have.
It's almost a book only a military brat could write, just, or, you know, somebody with the nomadic, living a nomadic lifestyle.
Yeah, I occasionally get to share that experience with people who've had an otherwise nomadic lifestyle because their parents were in the convention business or in the carnival business, or they were part of agriculture in a way that moves around during part of the year, like people who move bees to pollinate crops. But for the most part, it's a very American experience of growing up itinerant and living just outside many major cities, which is what I think most brats have been through.
Yeah. And you have to, it's a whole different world. And, you know, I make friends really fast, but you have to be able to detach from friends, and civilians don't really adjust to that well. You know, what do you mean you haven't called it? Yeah, but we'll pick up and we'll, you know, carry on where we left off. No big deal.
No, it's very true. And I think it conditions you to independence a lot earlier than most people become independent. I have a lot of friends who told me that they weren't allowed to spend the night away from home, or that they weren't allowed to go to the store by themselves or walk to school by themselves until they were, you know, 10, 11, 12. Yeah. And I remember being 7 years old and having to have my ID with me always, and having to be able to recite my identification and to identify myself to, you know, a policeman or foreign government. And even now, when I have friends who are adults who are like, oh, I left home without my driver's license, I'm always like, how?
Yeah.
That's not possible. Like, you're not allowed to do that. So I think if I had been raised differently, I might have had a bigger struggle toward independence. But as things were, I was as ready as any young kid can be.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different life, definitely. I don't know that I'd change my traveling around. I mean, there's things I'd change about my youth, sure, but I like traveling around. And you adjust to it, and it's like every 2 years or 3 years or a year, you get a whole new
move on
friends. Yeah. And she made everybody think when I was in the last place, you get to move. It's okay.
It's true. I hated it when I was a kid because I wanted, you know, I wanted the Huxtables life. I wanted to live in the same house and know the same people and cultivate a feeling of home and be able to keep my best friends. But I do look at it back. I look back on it now and realize it was an advantage in many ways. I've learned to adapt to local custom. I've learned to watch people carefully and read them very easily. And to adapt to different circumstances all the time. It does make you a little itchy, though. It's made living in one place as an adult almost impossible. Every 2 years, I just start looking around and say, well, time to pack all this up.
Yeah, it does. This is the longest I've lived anywhere, and it's been, I guess, 11 or 12 years now. And that, to other people, that's nothing. They've been in the same place, never even been out of their state for 30 or 40 years. But it's after about 2 or 3 years anywhere, like, okay, what's next? Where are we going? You know, start looking at houses and other
right. Houses
or apartments. Okay, let's get back to the book here. How did you get into writing?
All I've ever wanted to be was a writer. I had minor moments in my life where I wanted to be an opera singer and when I wanted to be a doctor before I realized how much math I'd have to do. But through all of that, I've loved reading and I've loved writing, and I always wanted that to be, if not my vocation, at least an avocation. I started writing for competition and for, you know, academic success in about fifth grade. I became serious about it. And I won my first writing contest that year when I was 10. And the feeling of it was just, it was obscene. It was like I was King Kong on cocaine. Like, I'd never had a rush before like that in my life. And like, I had my work performed live and I got a little prize money and I got my first publication, you know, just like a little school bound journal, but still, yeah. And I've been stuck on it ever since. I mean, it was just the best feeling. So I came back to it and went away from it. And I ran an underground version of my high school's newspaper when I was a teenager, because I didn't like our school paper and I didn't feel like it represented me. And there was that feeling again, like I would walk through the halls and I would see people reading my paper and it was just a rush like nothing else. So I started writing short stories and...
So wait. An underground version of your newspaper? So did you have other people helping you write it, or was it just all you?
I did. Yeah, no. So there was the official school newspaper, which was, you know, run with a teacher as an advisor and had like really strict rules about what they were allowed to say. And I thought, you know, what if we had an underground version of this? What if it was, you know, Notes from the Underground? What if it was the resistance papers? Of course, I was, you know, obsessed with myself as a figure of justice. So I recruited a couple of other writers, and I got stories, and I got fiction, and I got poetry, and I got just random stuff. And then a friend of mine was in an ROP office, which we definitely stole Xerox copies from because we had no financial backing. Uh-huh. And it was just the best experience. And of course, the first day we published, when we started disseminating, I got yanked into the vice principal's office and he's like, you're not allowed to do this. And I had the school's handbook in my back pocket. And I was like, it says right here that I am. This is covered under my First Amendment rights. I just can't, I can't obstruct the flow of traffic around the school to distribute it. And he did not like that answer. He was very unhappy with it. But I ran that paper for as long as I could.
That is awesome. How many years were you at that school?
I dropped out the middle of junior year, so let's say 3.5.
Yeah. Oh, so that was your only high school?
No, so that was my second high school,
okay. But
I moved there in the middle of freshman year, so I was okay. There from second semester freshman year until I dropped out.
Okay, that's longer than I've been at any high school, so I think I had 5 under my belt by the time I graduated, so...
Oh, that's impressive. I had I went to 12 or 13 elementary schools, but by then I was on my own, so I could mostly make a solid go of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I had 10 total. So it sounds like you bounced around a lot. And I didn't.
Yeah, we bounced a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So who are your, we haven't talked about this yet, I don't think. Who are your influences and your favorite authors, and what kind of genres do you read?
I read a lot and I read very widely. As much as I love science fiction and I do credit it with some of my best ideas, I also grew up reading fantasy and lit fic and poetry and memoir. I love memoir and collections of essays, and I really do try to read a little bit of everything. So when I was writing these books, I would say that my biggest influences were Virginia Woolf. I read Orlando at a very formative age, and it got me thinking about the way writers can do fun, fancy tricks with gender and what the expression of gender means inside the world of a story and also as commentary on our world. And I found that enormously inspiring. So I also read a lot of Margaret Atwood when I was preparing to do this, because I was looking for science fiction books that centered a woman's perspective, that had a woman author, that looked at gender as both advantage and disadvantage and fundamental difference, and the way that we are oppressed differently, the way that systems of oppression are asymmetrical along gender lines. That same asymmetry is very active in the work of Octavia Butler, who is also a huge influence on me, who was writing about the intersection of race and class and gender. She was way ahead of the curve. She was doing some deeply important work before even the Academy was ready to receive it. So when I read her books, it was like a bomb went off in my head. And I could say some of the same thing about Samuel Delaney, who was able to write about the experience of being queer in a way that was not widely accepted. I mean, Delaney was a hell of a brave person. I mean, he was doing it back in the 60s when he was still a kid. So all of those things had a lot of influence on me, as did, in a strange way, Jonathan Swift in Gulliver's Travels, because I wanted to look at the way we examine various societies based on how the same exact ritual act or fundamental act is viewed differently or valued differently because of how it's shaped by culture. So all of those came together in sort of a pot boiler of my imagination when I was working on these books.
Yes, it's really evident. It's really cool. Gulliver's Travels, it just makes me think, I mean, how can you not be drawn to that? I don't remember most of it. As a military brat, though, that's like, yeah, I get this. Yeah. So.
Right? Absolutely. Because you're always moving from place to place and thinking, gosh, that's different from how I remember it. But people here think it's funny instead of sad. You adjust.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more interesting than it, you don't get so stubborn about things, I think. Let's talk about the Book of Floras, your series, The Road to Nowhere, and the Book of Flora specifically. There is a lot in this book. There's a lot to unpack here. So I guess we can start what inspired this specific story. I'll start there.
So Flora grew out of the rest of the series. I knew by the time I finished the first one what the second book would be. I knew that I wanted to follow Etta and see what their experiences were going to be like and follow them across their rebellion against their own culture. And being situated in a place that was created during the falling apart of society and created a martyr or a religious figure out of a midwife has important consequences for people of all genders, but especially a person of a fluid gender, bi gender, or non-binary gender, the way that Etta/Eddie is. Sorry, small spoiler. Mm-hmm. And as I got deeper and deeper,
it's not that big of a spoiler.
Yeah, it is, not really. I mean, it's the very first chapter you find out, so now you know. But as I worked more into Etta, I became very interested in the character of Flora. First of all, I loved her. Like, she's one of the characters I've written who I love the most. And I was thinking about how trans women are the most heavily gendered individuals in our society that we think of male as default, as ungendered, as normal. And then we think of a female as deviant, as aberrant, and as the most gendered. So people who are women in a way that is different than being assigned female at birth are often viewed as the most extreme example of that. And so considering the politics of this world, where there are so few women, where procreation is so important, where the question of whether or not a woman can breed is so central, I thought that Flora would have an utterly unique perspective. And I also I loved her as a person. I loved the idea of someone who becomes a silk thrower and develops a personal relationship with silkworms, and someone whose character is primarily defined to other people by how she looks on the outside and how that affects, if you work from the outside in as a means of identity, what that means to you. And I wanted to follow her adventures. And most importantly, I wanted to put her in a position where she could take risks and endure terrors and still come through okay, because I very seldom read a character with those qualifications who has anything like a happy ending, and I wanted to see her through to the end.
Yeah, she does have a lot of adventure. She's you don't really get at the beginning that she wasn't female at birth.
Right. So you have to get pretty far into her story for that to be explained.
Into the story, but at least not in the beginning of the Book of Flora. But the strength that, and just the way she brushes things off is just like amazing to me. She seems very resilient.
She is incredibly resilient. And I really loved the idea of pushing through these works that are so difficult on the subject of gender to finally reach somebody who could almost see it as irrelevant. Someone who knew who they were in a deep and fundamental way and could discard everyone else's pressures about that. That was enormously freeing for me personally.
Yeah. And there's places she would go where it was extremely important, but not in the ways she thought they were important.
Exactly.
Other places where it was important that you identify as how you were identified at birth.
Right.
So many different little worlds. And each town is so incredibly different. I think that's another thing that a military brat can see is even in the United States, there's a lot of cultural differences. And you take that and make it even a smaller area, you put it across the Midwest and you know, Chicago is, or Shy is,
I'm glad you figured it out. A lot of people did not realize I was talking about Chicago when I called it Shy.
Chi-town, yeah.
And then, Chi-town, you know, that's it's
completely different than Omen and other places that are in nowhere. It's just incredible how you got all the cultural stuff in there. They are in such a small area, because I guess, you know, in the apocalypse thing, you've gone back to, it takes years to get across the country, you know?
Right. So not only that, these places have physical isolation because it takes weeks to go from Des Moines to Chicago by foot, and also lacking any kind of national media. Like, we have a lot of similarity right now because we're all watching the same TV, we're reading the same newspapers, we're listening to the same music. And in the conditions of apocalypse, we disrupt that system. Like, places that are different will only drift further apart. They will only become weirder and more foreign to each other.
Yeah, and that's
so
how
thinking about how weird it was for
separation and, you know, groups of animals or whatever get separated and things change. And when you have the outside world, it's going to be completely different from place to place.
That's straight out of Darwin, like looking at the difference between the same species separated by one Galapagos island. Like, humans are just that weird.
Yep. Well, I think the biggest culture shock for me, and I was overseas, I was in the Philippines for a couple years. That was not the biggest cultural shock. The biggest culture shock for me was going from Seattle to Oklahoma City.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge change.
Because you think it's going to be the same.
And it's not. Yeah, you think that. Yeah. Nope. It is in many ways. Go ahead.
I said, if you add in that, you know, post-apocalyptic stuff, okay, that's going to be even more of a change. You know, so I really enjoyed that aspect of it. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, there's some places where you move to and you think, you know, moving from Germany to Missouri is going to be weird, but it's not really that weird. And then moving from Missouri to Texas may as well be its own country. It's like another planet.
Yeah.
And there are regional differences you cannot prepare yourself for unless you've seen it.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of Germans in Missouri, you know?
Exactly. A lot, exactly. Yeah, so there are commonalities you don't expect.
In the U.S., I think German is after Spanish. So it's English, Spanish, and German. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, there's still a ton of people who speak German who came from there. So your cultural commonalities will carry you through, and then your regional differences will just knock you over.
Yeah, yeah. It is just insane. Talking about gender, you go really into gender here, what it means to be a woman specifically. You know, and it's hard to talk about this without spoiling Chicago.
I know, yeah.
Because there's so much to talk about there, and they really kind of go into what it means to be a woman and what a woman is and what a man is. And it's not necessarily what's in your pants.
It's almost never what's in your pants. That's the thing that kept coming back to me when I was working on this, is I was asking myself the question, what is a woman? And in almost every way we use to define that term is nebulous and ultimately meaningless, even when it's biological, because biology is so changeable and so adaptable and so resistant to categorization, especially binary categorization. So what you end up with is a it's a very spiritual answer on what it means to be a woman or be a man. And a lot of the trans writers that I've read have been tackling this exact subject and tackling it from a refreshing perspective, because they can, a trans person can often tell you what the experience of being fully one gender and fully the other gender, and gendered by other people primarily, is like, which is something that most cis people never experience. And it really did blow my mind. I just kept exploding the notion of gender for myself over and over. So yeah, so when I wrote The City of Shy as a city of all women, in a world where there are almost no women, I had to think hard about who is a woman and how much of that is a choice and how much of that is a role you fulfill in society, so the people around you just decide you're a woman.
Yeah. I mean, I remember reading about Juliet Gordon-Lowe. She was unable mm-hmm. to have children, and that made her...
Right.
Back then, post, or what is it called, antebellum South, it was,
right.
you know, that made you less of a woman. And there was some shame
right.
around it.
I read about the experience of lesbians and the women's suffrage movement, how they weren't considered actually women because their relationship to men wasn't the same.
Yeah.
And I read about people who just present as very butch, people who are stereotypically masculine, even though they are assigned female at birth, and how policies that were meant to keep trans people out of bathrooms almost always work against, say, butch lesbians.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they're the most likely people to be misgendered. And just
yeah.
how much of this is perception and based on norms and things like, you know, the growth of facial hair, and most AFAB people grow facial hair. Like, it's not a single characteristic. It's never designed to be ascertained by one thing, and we pretend that it is.
Yeah, it's so, but you packed all that into one town that it, you know, that's historical, you know, a lot of history in and you put it in the present, and then also a lot of cultural differences you put in one town. I mean, it's just like, as far as like cultural ideas of gender and behavior, it's just wow. I like the book is like there's so much here, but yeah, it's, you know, history has its own ideas, and then history, each place that history is different, and I don't know how you
it
do
is.
That. It was amazing.
There's a piece of Shy that I didn't make it into the book. It's one of those things that I know, but no one else necessarily has to know it. And it's that the beginning of what became Shy was founded by a sort of power couple. And one of them was a football coach, and one of them was a cheerleading coach, which is why their storytelling takes so much from cheerleading.
Oh,
and that,
yeah, I noticed that. Sounds like cheerleaders. Okay. So were they...
I was thinking about when I've been in Chicago, you know, how it's such a sporting city. Like, everybody has
yeah.
a favorite team. Everybody's really into sports there. So I was
yeah.
thinking, like, who could really make it in post-apocalyptic Chicago? And I was like, oh, they need sports people. That's what they need.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
those are such intensely gendered methods of storytelling. Like, you have football storytelling and you have cheerleading storytelling. And I was thinking
oh, yeah.
about how
That's
those things would
Texas
shake out.
And Oklahoma is football, so everything seems
it
like
is.
A lot of roles are based around football. Football culture. It's nuts.
It's very true.
Well, maybe football is based around that. I don't know. It could go either way, I guess. But yeah, so a cisgender football coach and a cisgender cheerleading coach, or were they trans, or?
Yeah. No, they were cis, and they were a married couple, and
okay.
they both saw their ability to organize and motivate people as a fundamental reason why they should seek power, and they ended up being really good at it. But then I did a lot of research into something called the founder effect, and the founder effect is it's a genetic thing. So like people who found a society who were the beginning of a village, their genes are often still present in that place a long time later, because the original pool of people who were interbreeding was so small that it gets reinforced. So like there's a high percentage of deaf people living in Martha's Vineyard because it's essentially an island, and some of the founders carried genetic deafness. So I was thinking about the founder effect in a cultural sense. Like, if the people who founded your civilization were really into football, how would football be carried through that culture, through the founder effect? And I had a huge amount of fun with that, because every place would have its own founders, and their founders would have their preferences and their skills and their differences, and that would become part of the fabric of that society.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, that's interesting. I'll have to look that up. I've got my ideas about Lawrence. Was the town I'm in, Lawrence, was founded by a group from Massachusetts as a free town during, as part of the whole Bleeding Kansas thing, during slavery, just before the Civil War. And they would come and, you know, people were trying to claim Kansas and make it a free territory or a slave territory, depending. And, but it was a colony from Massachusetts, essentially. And I do notice there's a little bit of kind of cultural similarities here between here and the Northeast.
Right.
I don't wonder, but anyway, but you're talking about genetic, not just culture, which is interesting too.
Yeah, so the word comes from the genetic effect, but when I was reading about it, I was like, there's huge cultural effects that are basically the founder effect. I couldn't get away from the idea once I had it in my mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about our own countries founded in the United States, the...
Right.
Still doing...
If you think about the... We are. These guys have been
politics-wise. It's all rich white guys.
Exactly, and their ideas about individualism and self-determination and the importance of private property, like all that comes from the founding of our country, which happened a long time ago, and it still carries through.
And that's why people who think differently are looked at as just insane. I don't know.
That's it.
But it is. It's really hard to change things. You know, this idea of independence, when really it's interdependence that is what we're doing, but you know, we got to be independent. That's I've got to look this up now. Let's see, what else was I going to ask you? One of my favorite lines in this book, I think my favorite line in this book is, how does it go? Love and sex are just something for life and death. Like, hold on, I'll find it.
I believe in you.
You believe me. Do you know what you wrote? Do you remember it?
Not off the top of my head. No, I try not to be one of those writers who's incessantly quoting myself.
Oh, it was a really good line. I was hoping you knew it.
This is kind of great because it's one that I haven't heard a million times from everybody. So it's kind of nice that you didn't pick the same one everybody else picks.
Oh, what did everybody else pick? Okay.
So the most common highlights from that book are, we don't stay free because of something we did once. We stay free because we fight our way free every day. What about death and grief being an old chain? People will believe anything if you don't teach them how to reason for themselves.
There's a lot of good, that one line you just read to me. What was that line? Free because you have to fight free every day.
Yeah, we don't stay free because of something we did once. We stay free because we fight our way free every day. That was one of the hardest things I learned growing up. Like, there's no finish line. There's no, there, we did that, and we never have to do it again. That never happens. Like, you have to keep doing it over and over and over.
Yeah, that is true. That's very true with life. You think you're done, and nope, you're not. But especially for stuff that's worth fighting for. You always have to do that, you know. You can't just come out, for example, as bisexual people know, you don't just come out once all the time, and then you got to really fight for your place all the time.
Every time. And you have to fight past people's expectations of what that means, about their assumptions that you're straight if you happen to be in a hetero pair bond. I mean, it's a lifelong process of explaining to people that you're buying for whatever it's worth.
Yeah. And then this, what does that matter then?
right. Like, it matters to me. It is still part of my identity. It is still valid. I know multiple, especially bisexual women. I know lots of them who know they're bisexual, who identify that as in themselves and have never really been able to express it because they got into the kind of marriage they were expected to get into and are monogamous and expect to stay married. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
They're no less bi. They're definitely, they belong to us.
Yeah, definitely. I'm one of those. All right, well, I had a life before I got married, but I've been in marriage for 22 years, I think.
Wow.
Sorry, same guy. But that doesn't mean I'm dead.
Nope. It's still true. It's still part of you.
And it does. It bleeds its way into things and how you do things and how you relate to your partner, no matter what gender they are.
It does.
So
That's true. And it leads certainly into what you want to read and what kind of representation you might seek out and what books you might be interested in that people don't realize that that's for you.
yeah. And just that fight, you know, you really have to fight about it all the time. Yeah, you have to fight. It means to fight for it all the time. Not
constantly,
just,
yeah.
Let's see what else about this book hit me. I loved the imagery in it. I was really cool, all your the visual in it, and the and not just visual but taste, like oranges tasting like sunshine, and the just all the senses are there.
Thank you.
It was so cool.
It's a very sensual book.
That might be hard for some people, but
oh yeah,
I plugged through it. It was worth it.
I always try to warn people before they get into my books. Like, I've written something very violent and very graphic, and I've engaged with the nature of sexual assault and sexual oppression, sexualized oppression. A lot of it's from my own experience, and a lot of it is taken from firsthand accounts of terrible things. And yeah. If those are hard subjects for you, if you hate reading books that have rape in them, like, this just isn't for you, and that's completely okay. And yeah. Be gentle with yourself and make the right decision. But I wrote that stuff as part of this world because it's been part of my world, and I couldn't tell the truth any other way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very honest. That's cool.
That's it. Thank you.
And you do have to have some sort of strength to do that, to write that if you've been through sexual assault or sexual
yeah.
trauma to get to that.
And there are plenty. Sure. And there's plenty of writers who I know have survived their own sexual trauma and choose because of that to never make it part of their fiction. They get to banish it from their work and from their life.
Yeah.
And they're just as strong, and the work they're doing is just as important. I don't want to ever want to say that I'm doing this better than anybody, but this is what worked for me.
Yeah. Well, there's a different kind of strength too. It's a strength to know what you can deal with and how to take care of yourself, and all that's part of recovery.
Absolutely true. Yeah.
Right. It's just a different way of dealing with it, which it's cool too, that you could banish it and it just make it not exist in your life.
Exactly. You get to be in charge. That is the best thing by far about being a writer, is you are god of this little world that you've created.
Yeah.
It sounds macabre, but it's totally true.
It is cool. I could take it coming from someone who's been through it a lot more easily than I can take I got tired of it. I love The Walking Dead. I do.
Right. Yeah.
I got tired of it in that real quick. It's like, okay, they have to be able to go somewhere without getting assaulted.
Right.
And
right.
They have to be so gross about it. But yeah. And it was obviously something you hadn't been through it. It was all gore. It was not about the experience and the person, the trauma they went through and dealing with that trauma. It was just, what's the word?
It's gratuitous. It's written for shock value. And I think there's a really big line there. Like, people act like it's a subtle difference, and it's not. Like, I've read a lot of rape scenes that are gratuitous, that are meaningless, that, you know, aren't happening to real people, or that are even eroticized. And that is not cool to read at all.
No, no. If it's about someone who, and you're trying to show the strength that they had to get through something, that's one thing. If it's just to entertain somebody else who's kind of sick in the head, that's something entirely different. I think I ended up writing a book review on their Amazon site. You cut it out. Who did this character? Why do we have to do this to her?
Right. A lot of times it's meaningless. A lot of times it's meant to motivate a male character to have his revenge because her body belongs to him. And like, that is so tired and so lazy.
Yeah.
So I try to write people who've experienced assault, and it changes who they are. And it changes how they relate to themselves and their sense of independence and their sense of bodily autonomy. And that's all stuff that I've had to parse out. And it's not so that your boyfriend will get mad and become the Green Lantern.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. So this, I was like, oh crap, what did I get into? But I got, you know, I'm like, no, actually, let me just see where this goes. And it ended up being great stories, especially Edda/Eddie.
Thank you.
I didn't read the first two books. I just read this third one.
Oh, interesting.
So I started you know, I just didn't have time to read the whole trilogy, but I don't know if that transformation happened in the second book or if Edda became Eddie just right there in the third book, but it seems to be some movement going from Edda to Eddie even in the third book there. And there's kind of a
transition. There is. I wanted to keep Eddie fluid. I wanted to make it so that Eddie could go through a changeable sense of their own identity, because sometimes it is safer for Eddie to be Edda, and sometimes it is safer and better for Edda to be Eddie. And that is explored in greater depth and in more meaningful ways, and kind of placed within the context of how they grew up in the Book of Edda. So if you're interested in that transformation, yeah, I'd recommend the second book. But I don't think I've heard from anybody before who's read the third one and not the first two, and I'm always fascinated to know how it lands if you don't know how we got here. So I'm really glad you enjoyed it as much as you did without the background. That's wonderful to know.
It does stand alone very well.
Thank you.
It catches you up, and I think it was almost liberating to read this third one first, because I'm not caught up into the midwife character and don't see that character as a saint, or I haven't idolized any characters previously, and it sounds like that midwife character is does some really kick-ass things, but I'm not attached.
That makes it very different. I'm into it.
Yeah, yeah. You should go read your own books. Just read the last one first.
It would be so weird to be able to read them without knowing them. Maybe in like 20 years, I'll be able to read back and wonder who the hell wrote this, you know?
Yeah. What crap is it now? But I always do that with my own writings. What did I write? Oh my God.
I'm getting there. I used to have a really good memory for my work, but now there's so much of it.
Have you read The Lord of the Rings at all?
Of course, yeah, I read it when I was a kid.
Did you read The Silmarillion?
Yes, I slogged through it. I don't know what possessed me, but I just had to know.
But don't you get to the end of that and like, why did this book not come first?
Right. So I think a lot of it in ways it did. I think Tolkien was doing the research and putting all that stuff together, but he didn't think of it as being for publication. Yeah. So it does come first in a way, but it's weird that you get it after the fact.
Yeah, he should have gotten that all out first, and then. But it's okay to read things out of order. That's why.
It absolutely is. Yes.
Yeah, and in the Book of Flora was definitely a good enough book that it didn't matter that I read it out of order.
I'm so glad to hear it.
I loved all the librarians and the just the whole idea of gender in here is just so amazing, and sexuality. Which seemed to be kind of like not as much a focus as gender.
I wanted to kind of decouple them, because sexuality and gender are not, after all, the same thing. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of needs people have that are sexual that are not gendered, and there are lots of gendered needs that people have that are not sexual. And by decoupling those things, I was able to explore some really different character models than I'm used to. Like, I really wanted to write Alice because I can't remember the last time I saw a slutty genius. And I wanted to write somebody who was bisexual and very sexual and very open, and also a brilliant chemist and a savior of her people and like a genius among doctors. And how decoupling gendered behavior from sexual behavior really helped me see my way clear to that. And that was so much fun.
Yeah, it's a really good book. It's like, you know, like I said, when I'm starting, I'm like, I'm not sure about this. But then it's got so much in it. And there's just so much to take part and unpack and look at in it. Highly recommend
it. Has a really hard start. It's a difficult place to get in. Like, Flora starts in a bad place, but there's lots waiting for you if you can get through it.
Definitely. So something happened that I don't know about between her and Eddie before this book.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that happens in the Book of Edda. Yep.
Okay. And now I know. Okay. It'll be cool. It's all right. It'll be cool to read it.
Cool.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with this book? Or any other works we know about?
I have my first collection coming out next year. It's through a small press in Berkeley, which is right here where I live, called PM Press, and it's going to be called Big Girl and Other Stories. And it features my short story, Big Girl, which was published by Fantasy and Science Fiction a couple years ago and was a Tiptree honor. So I'm very, very proud of it. And there's also going to be a bunch of previously unpublished new work in that book and some essays as well. So I can't wait to show everybody that. And it'll be out in 2020. And it looks like so my first young adult novel, but I don't have a date on that yet. So I have a YA novel forthcoming.
And did you say what the title was?
Yeah, the title of the YA novel is Find Layla.
Find Layla. Anything else you want to add that maybe we missed?
I do want to say that there are a lot of amazing bi creators working in science fiction these days. And if you're not finding the books that you want that represent bisexuality or any other part of your identity, to look at new readers. A lot of people will recommend the same golden age science fiction books over and over and over, and the golden age is hugely overshadowed with white straight cis dudes. And that the new work in science fiction, the best, most exciting work, is coming from queer women and non-binary people and asexual writers. And it's a really exciting time in the genre. So if you want new stuff, come find new writers. We are out here.
Who's your favorite besides yourself?
J.Y. Young is the author of the Tenseret series. They're non-binary and their work is incredible. K.M. Sparra was nominated for the Hugo a couple of years ago, and he wrote one of my favorite novellas. It's called Small Changes Over Long Periods of Time. It's about a dude who's becoming a trans man at the same time that he's becoming a vampire. And it's groundbreaking. And Kellen has his first book out next year. It's called Docile. It's going to blow your mind. Sarah Pinsker, who's a queer woman who writes about punk rock in the future, just had her debut come out called Song for Another Day. All of these are incredible.
Awesome. I knew you had good recommendations.
I overflow with recommendations at any moment.
Mick Collins came out with a horror novel just last month that's available. Michael,
what's it called?
Michael R. Collins, yeah. And he's one of the hosts here. I'm putting in a plug for you, Mick.
Fantastic.
Yeah, there are a ton of, one of the things I've noticed since doing this podcast is there are a ton of bi writers out there that write for us and for our community. They write for everybody, but they reach out to us through their writing, and it's really, really awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love that. I love how bi writers are good at inhabiting different points of view, but also if you know what you're looking for, you're like, this story is so bi.
Yeah. And there's things like, you know, like in your books, even you notice little things here and there, like speak to you. And it's just refreshing to have that perspective now and to feel, you know, that it's not an abnormal thing, that it's a normal part of life and part
Absolutely
of
Absolutely is, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. Well, if you don't have anything else, I guess that's all. So that's all we have.
That's it. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. This was really great.
Yeah, thanks to you. Thanks to our guest, Beck Elison. The book is The Book of Flora, Part 3 of the Road to Nowhere series. Real quick, what are the other two books? The Book of Edda is the second one, and
The Book of the Unnamed Midwife is the first one. That's the one that won the Philip K. Dick Award.
Okay. Oh, cool. Yeah, I really enjoyed our time together. We'll have to have you back on sometime. Let us know.
I would love that. Thank you.
Remember, there's a whole Bi Plus universe ready to embrace you. Reach out and find your community.